Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome back to the Weekly Critic podcast. I am Ben Sixsmith and I'm delighted to be joined today by my excellent colleague, Joe Bartosz. Joe, how are you today?
I'm very well, thank you. Delighted to be here.
Delighted to have you. Now, Joe is my excellent colleague at The Critic magazine, but she's also been a prolific freelance writer for many different outlets. Joe, how did you get into freelancing initially?
I mean, essentially because I'm fundamentally unemployable. So I've tried a variety of false starts in sort of getting started on a career. So, you know, I've been a painter decorator. I've worked for the local housing sort of authority. I've tried to sort of set up a business selling hippie rubbish. So, you know, I've done lots of false starts, and pretty much the only thing I've succeeded in is writing. So I think the first time anyone suggested that I could write was when I'd done a leaflet advertising the sort of hippie tap that I was selling at the time with an ex of mine, and I was giving them out in the pub for some reason. Marketing isn't a strong point, and some bloke came up to me and said, "Oh, as one writer to another, these are really good." And I thought it was just a cheesy pickup line, so I told him to sod off. and have subsequently come to realise maybe he was being genuine. And I guess sort of how I've got into it really is because one constant through everything has always been campaigning. So I've always, you know, I've never been content to leave politics to the politicians. So I sort of used to set up anti-war groups and feminist groups and that sort of thing. And obviously that involves writing and you know, trying to sort of lobby. I ran quite a large feminist group in a town called Cheltenham, which is not known for its to be a sort of a hotbed of radicalism. And there's a problem there with lap dancing clubs and prostitution during the racing, which, you know, is a kind of seedy underbelly to the otherwise sort of quite idyllic Cotswold town. So it was quite successful after a while, and I was offered a column in the local paper. So I thought, oh, well, you know, at the time I had so little confidence I couldn't even post on Facebook. I was really sort of awkward. So I started writing a weekly column for the local paper, and that did surprisingly well. I mean, obviously I got a lot of kickback, because you do every time you say anything unpopular about women's rights. But I realised I actually rather liked it, and I didn't care about the hassle. So I started to pitch to nationals, but I still don't really understand how newspapers work. So it was always from the outside, and I'd sort of pitch opinion to the features desk and to the news desk, and I sort of got everything wrong all the time. But I just did an absolute sort of scattergun approach. So like the first time I had a lead feature in a national newspaper, I had to look up what a feature was. it's been a sort of process of learning from the outside. I'm quite proud of the progress I've made.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I also came into writing in a kind of roundabout way. And I think in a weird sense, that can almost be an advantage, because when someone does take a more traditional route of kind of, you know, they go to university, then they have the internships and, you know, they're in London, I think maybe you can almost get overawed and you're like, well, I can't pitch to this person because, you know, he's so way above me. And, you know, I can't really pitch to this place. Whereas if you don't really know how the industry works, you're just kind of knocking on the chief editor's door and you're saying, hello, acknowledge me.
Totally. I think sheer ignorance is definitely an advantage sometimes.
I don't know about you, but I often get questions about writing. I mean, I don't want to sound too much like the kind of comedian who does long, earnest, unfunny podcasts about the art of comedy. But I thought maybe we could, you know, bring some inspiration to the table. And one question I often get asked is, you know, how do you find time to write? And as I say, you're a very prolific writer. I see your columns all the time for us and for other outlets. So how do you make the time, not just find the time, because of course it's one thing to have the time, but it's another to use it properly. So how do you make the time to be able to write?
I'm privileged in that I don't have children. I think I don't know how the hell, I mean, fair dues to some of your columnists like, you know, Victoria Smith and all the rest of it, who managed to balance caring alongside, you know, motherhood alongside careers. I think that's incredible. So essentially, you know, apart from brushing my cats, it's pretty much all I have to do. And I'm not going to lie, you know, the financial incentive, the fact that if I don't write, I don't get paid, helps me find the time. I suspect I would probably earn more money doing almost anything else. But it is important to me, and I do enjoy doing it. I think time, I mean, I am in awe of those people who can get up at 6 a.m. and dedicate 2 hours a day to, you know, solidly working on something. I can't do that. I tend to sort of get all excited by an idea at about, you know, 11:30 at night. And then, much to the irritation of my partner, we'll sort of stay up working till 4. So I think really slot it in when you can, and write when you're feeling passionate and angry about something.
How do you get so many ideas? Or is it just quite a kind of quite a random process where something just does strike you as something that must be written about?
I mean, sometimes, to be honest, I actually rather like being told what to write about, because then I can moan like hell about it in my head and think, oh, this is really boring, I don't care about it. And then I will inevitably find something interesting within it. And I think sometimes parameters are quite useful. I think, yeah, having absolute freedom and choice to write about anything can sometimes be quite overwhelming. What I tend to find, you know, sometimes I'll agonize over something and it will be a bit rubbish. I think sometimes the best pieces are when they're sort of immediate and it comes from, I'm not a terribly emotional person. I'm never aware of how I'm feeling until I start writing, and then it tends to come out. So I suspect there's probably something there about feeling strongly about things that allows it to come out.
Right. It's good to feel more invested in the process as it goes along than to have, you know, sometimes I have this initial rush of passion when I start a project, and then as I go on, I think, oh no, it's like a balloon deflating. So if you can pick up momentum as you go, that's much better.
Totally, totally. I don't know how people write longer form pieces. It's like after about 1,500 words, you know, 1,000 or so words, and it's like, yeah, now I'm bored now. I kind of lose my vim. I don't know how people do books.
You need to walk away from it for a long time and then come back to it when your energy is restored. Absolutely. It's not something you can do in a kind of ultra marathon pace. You know, in my experience, you need to run a little bit and then you come back and you do something else, and then you run a little bit and then you come back and do something else. But yeah, I find it to be a challenge as well, writing more longer form pieces. Now, a lot of your pieces, definitely not all of them, but a lot of them are based around what I'll kind of clumsily call the gender wars. I can't think of a better term for it. But how did you get involved with this issue?
Oh God, I hope I don't ramble too much. But so I told you I've always sort of been interested in politics and campaigning. And I set up a feminist group around about sort of 2010 or so. And it was quite popular for a while. And I'd always had a feminist understanding of gender essentially as a set of sexist stereotypes, as like a social straitjacket about how men and women ought to be. So I always thought it was something rather negative. And then I had briefly a very woke boyfriend who said, oh, I think that's a really cruel view. Oh, that's really mean to trans people. And for a while, I doubted myself. And I think within the sort of leftist groups at the time, there just wasn't any opposition to that. So I sort of somehow, without even noticing, absorbed these quite two contradictory ideas, whereby on the one hand, gender identity was innate and liberating for trans people, it was a bit shit for women, which clearly it doesn't make any sense. So I was organising a fundraising event. And I wrote on some, you know, I've never been particularly engaged with popular culture, to be honest. And I made some flyers and I just lazily wrote on them because I was virtue signaling, you know, celebrating wonderful women from Caitlyn Jenner to Emma Watson. I didn't even know who Caitlyn Jenner was, particularly, other than a bloke, and therefore, you know, worthy of being celebrated. So I was picked up on this by a woman at the event. And I was absolutely horrified, because I'd just got together with my first girlfriend, who's now my wife. And in my head, it was sort of criticism of transgenderism was synonymous with homophobia. I just sort of lost all of the analysis that I had held on to for years and absorbed this absolute nonsense. And so I was horrified. I burst into tears. And as I say, I'm not a massively emotional person. So I thought, well, that's weird. So I arranged to meet with her a couple of days later, basically, so I could, you know, tell her the error of her ways and talk her around. And she taught me around. And then I just felt really angry that I'd been lied to about this apparently vulnerable group. And I suddenly realised, hang on a minute, there's absolutely no difference between a man who identifies as trans and a cross-dresser. Because there isn't, because it's the same thing. And quite often it's the same sexual motivator. And, you know, I've known a lot of cross-dressers, fine, no issue with it, but they're not a persecuted minority. And suddenly I realised that it was essentially a men's sexual rights movement. And I started reading and getting angry. And then I was just absolutely mystified that people weren't furious about it. And that it just seemed so obvious to me that it was damaging. And I started thinking about, you know, I've done a lot of work campaigning about women in Yarl's Wood Detention Centre. And it made me start thinking about prisons and detention centres and the fact that men were clearly being put in with women. And that's really, so that was about 2015. And I've been writing about it since then. And the first piece I had in a mainstream paper about it was 2017. And I wrote about children who were sort of proto-LGB, who misunderstood their feelings of same-sex attraction as evidence of being transgender. And I had a mad reaction. I mean, there was, I had sort of blogs written about me, particularly by Natasha Kennedy or Mark Helen, who's a lecturer at Goldsmiths. He was furious. And then I was asked a couple of weeks later by The Independent to amend the article to include WPATH guidelines, which, you know, I didn't know a lot about journalism. To be honest, I still don't. But I knew that was very, very wrong, that I'd been essentially asked to retrospectively edit an article. Mm-hmm. And I told them to sod off. And I didn't get any more pictures accepted there. And it's probably not somewhere I'd bother trying again, given Patrick Strudwick's latest. I think that was a real sort of wake-up call that journalists were clearly being censored on the issue, or attempts were being made to censor journalists on the issue. Does that answer your question?
Oh, it definitely answers my question.
Good, okay.
Wonderfully. And it's funny when you say you started writing about it in 2015, because in the context of this issue, that feels like just so long ago. There are some things that we were debating in 2015, much as we're debating now, same arguments, you know, same tenor of debate. They're almost timeless. You know, if we're talking about the economy, we're talking about war, we're talking about various other issues. But this debate just kind of took hold of the cultural conversation. Yesterday, of course, Kathleen Stock was at the union, and there was protesters sticking themselves to the floor. What do you think it is about this issue that has attracted such intense feeling, you know, on both sides, at such pace and with such force?
So I think there's sort of students with stupid haircuts who think this is a civil rights issue. I kind of feel sorry for them, because essentially there isn't a lot more we can do so far as progress goes, I think, so far as civil rights campaign goes. And that should be something that's celebrated, but instead this sort of confected campaign has been created. And I think part of the driver for that, and part of the intensity of the emotion, is that it has been made deeply personal rather than ideological. So I think particularly for men who identify as women, I don't think they're even necessarily always aware that what they're identifying as is a two-dimensional fetishistic image of what they see as a woman. And what they see as a woman is often based on pornographic stereotypes. So, you know, it is insulting at every bloody level. But at the same time, I think that sort of really primal, visceral sort of driver, the fact it's sort of connected to sex, makes it really hard to challenge in a rational, calm, logical way. Because obviously men are going to defend their sex right, their identity. It's so sort of bound up with that. I can see it's never going to be popular to take their toys away. I think with regard to the sort of blue haired students who are comically also consider themselves quite often anti-capitalist, seem blissfully unaware of the fact that obviously every major corporation and indeed pharmaceutical companies are going to be supporting this and do support this, in part because there is obviously a huge amount of money to be made from pushing the idea that that authenticity can be reached by altering bodies, by body modification, by taking hormones, and it is a form of, I guess, it's been said a billion times, but it's like a neo-Gnosticism, that the idea is sort of separating mind from body. That's clearly mining that seam is going to make a lot of money. So I think you have very naive and well-intentioned students looking for a cause, and this has conveniently been put in front of them.
Yeah, I see what you mean. Every generation has had their great causes. Mm-hmm. And this has somehow become one of the major causes of this generation. But is that because the cause seems so important, or because it seems so important to have a cause? I think that's a very interesting question. And yeah, you talk about this, the separation of mind and body. Another subject you've written on us for recently is pornography and the sex trade, where often it feels as if people are trying to separate the sexual act from kind of emotional, if you want to say it in a kind of broad way, spiritual life.
Yeah.
And you say this was actually one of the issues that first led you towards writing and campaigning, where you were talking about the issues you faced in Cheltenham. But it's often an issue that gets overlooked. You know, I think people, if you talk about the harms of pornography or the sex trade, they think you're kind of Mary Whitehouse marching out of the 1970s, bringing back, you know, this fundamentalist Christianity. Why was this an issue that particularly attracted your attention to begin with?
I think I'd always considered myself on the left. I don't think I do anymore, actually. But I think as part of that, I've always been concerned about social justice. And when you look at the background of the women involved in the sex industry, a pattern emerges. Many of them have been abused in childhood. Many of them come from, have had quite traumatic experiences that have led them into the industry. It's often a maladaptive coping strategy. And when you look at, for example, we know a lot of the girls who were groomed in Rotherham went on into the sex industry. That there isn't a sort of clear line between a sort of happy hooker who makes an informed choice and decides to sell sex and trafficking and grooming. And it is a worldwide huge business. So, even from a sort of socialist point of view, it's absolutely bizarre that you have leftists defending this, because it's obviously a huge and lucrative industry. I think the idea that sexuality can be privatized, can be commercialized, can be sort of taken and removed from being relational and can be sold back to people. Because, I think people are pulled, particularly men, into these sort of vortices online, where they can then, you look at rates of erectile dysfunction, you look at the fact that a lot of men can now only achieve orgasm through looking at pornography. And clearly their sexuality has been robbed from them, has been taken from them by people who are making money from it. And that can't be a good thing. And then when you look at, say, the women in the industry, almost every well-known female porn actor has had a history of trauma. And something we know about trauma is that it separates, it induces a separation between mind and body. That's part of it. That's how people respond. That's why they sort of switch off and can smile whilst they're essentially being abused. So I think the sort of the industrial sort of utilization of that, if you like, to promote something, to push something, to push an idea, is just very dangerous. And it just has always struck me as a particularly pernicious form of abuse that everyone turns a blind eye to, because the minute sex is involved, somehow you're not allowed to criticize it, for fear that people will think you're, oh, I don't know, not sexy yourself. I mean, it's utterly ridiculous, but I really do think it's that vain. I think it's that shallow. People are worried that people will think they're, particularly women, that men will think they're prudish if they criticize the sex industry. Well, I just don't care. It's got to be done.
That's a very healthy attitude to take towards being disagreed with, I have to say. Obviously, the biggest driver of the sex trade and pornography is the male libido. But you hit on an interesting point that's used to kind of rationalize accepting the pervasiveness of pornography, which is it has been, reframed as sex work. And sometimes it does seem like progressive commentators think sex work is the only kind of work that has somehow escaped being exploitative and oppressive. Why do you think there is that drive towards legitimizing it, almost placing it beyond critique? Because as you say, it really doesn't fit well with other left-wing attitudes towards exploitation in the workplace or the objectification of women. I mean, where does this come from?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a parallel there with the way that people used to talk about domestic abuse as something private and behind closed doors. And I think it's a weirdly a similar sort of mindset whereby, all mustn't interfere, it's private, it's sort of sacrosanct somehow. I think it's sort of considered almost sacred the minute choice is involved, or not choice, sexuality is involved. And it's sort of, yeah, these ideas around, I think choice is a very reductive concept. I think empowerment is essentially bloody meaningless because there is never a transfer of power. But these words are used to sort of agency, all these words are used to dress something up that, the naked truth of is pretty bloody unpleasant. I think the reason really, I mean, the left, well, say the left has always had a problem with misogyny. I think there's always been a problem with misogyny, full stop. I don't, but I think that the thing that's always surprising to people is that somehow I think a lot of women on the left expect better of their comrades. Well, it's nonsense. And I think again, a bit like with transgenderism, they're essentially supporting men's sexual rights. So of course, there's a blind spot around it, and anything that seeks to curb that, which might say traditionally, aside from feminism, might traditionally be the conservative right, which might be the religious right, is thereby seen as the enemy. So in order to sort of achieve liberation and pull down those boundaries, which coincidentally happen to protect women, I think the sort of default approach is male liberation, yay.
Yeah, I mean, you have to look at who's getting the most gratification out of this whole industry, and it's certainly not the performers. I mean, even if you want to look at it in kind of economic terms, we published an interesting article recently which looked at the economics of OnlyFans, where the kind of top 0.5% of performers, I'll use performers slightly in air quotes, they really do make bank, and they're buying their first houses and celebrating it, and then it's all over the media. But what they don't look at is just the miserable amount of money that everybody underneath them gets. So, I mean, I don't think we'd accept this kind of romanticization of a fairly cutthroat industry if it was pretty much any other form of labor. I mean, if it was people saying top 0.5% of performers on Spotify, oh, everybody has to have a band. And obviously, that doesn't have the same, I think we can all agree that doesn't have the same implications for somebody's emotional life or, their social life as the porn industry. But yeah,
And I
like you say,
mean,
it's tough to make that argument and not come across as if you're coming from a very traditionalist standpoint. And I mean, I do come from a more right-wing conservative standpoint than yours, but it's not just a conservative argument to be made. It's an argument you can very well make in progressive terms.
Yeah, I mean, essentially, it's about human rights. I mean, which really should surpass any sort of political boundaries. But yeah.
Sometimes these kind of arguments feel depressingly unwinnable. I mean, we can all make these little kind of sort of baby steps forward. This little law isn't passed, or this little law is passed. But there rarely seems to be much kind of unification across these ideological divides. If we look kind of 20 years into the future, obviously we don't know what it's going to look like. But do you think the gender wars, for example, do you think there can ever be a kind of peaceful resolution, or are people just going to be continually making these arguments and little micro debates backwards and forwards?
In a way, I don't think there has to be a sort of winning of the argument, if you like. I mean, I think what we need to return to, we just need to wrestle back reality. And once that's done, once we have laws that reflect reality, and once we sort of just return back to those fundamental things, that's a structure, that's a baseline, that's a starting point. And then within that, if people want to believe mad things about gender identity, that's really entirely up to them and whatever. I mean, just so long as they're not empowered by the law to enforce that on other people. So I think that's the sort of the baseline. I don't really think it's a compromise. I think it's just an acknowledgement of reality by the state that that's what needs to happen. And yeah, within that, I mean, I'm not an illiberal person. I think it totally makes sense that people should be allowed to believe what they want, just not that the rest of the world should be expected to pander to it. So yeah, and I get sort of slightly frustrated with the sort of, people talking about compromise and, maybe we can sort of slightly amend the definition of women so that men who have had their balls chopped off can be women, really. Or no. I mean, just we all know what it is. I think we just need to return to reality before we start sort of claiming any sort of victory.
Yeah, that is the funny thing about this whole broader debate, which is that sometimes people will very narrowly focus on, should we allow trans people in mixed martial arts? And then they don't address that overall question of, how are we actually going to define the sexes? Because it's much more comfortable to focus on, should we allow them in this weight class of mixed martial arts? Or, should we allow them in this top league rugby team? And then this more kind of existential question just gets neglected, but you really have to answer that if you're going to answer everything underneath it. Because if
Yeah.
you do say,
And
for example, trans women are women, well, can you exclude them from those other things without being inconsistent? So I see what you mean about the nature of reality is really what we're debating, and then everything else is just kind of battles within the argument.
yeah, I mean, I think that's the genius of Kelly JK's J. Keane's campaign, is that it is so simple, and she has cut to the truth of it, is just the definition of woman. Yes, absolutely. And I think that's accessible and everybody understands that. Those who pretend it's sort of complicated are being disingenuous. It's not complicated. I mean, dogs know what sex people are. It's really not difficult.
I don't want to sound like an opportunistic Tory in asking this, because God knows the Conservative record in this issue is rather less than what we might expect. And I mean, I think to some extent, the progress they've made on this issue with, Rishi Sunak supporting Kathleen Stock yesterday, for example, it feels a little bit opportunistic themselves and, trying to dress up their record before the next election. So I'm not saying this to elevate them, but how optimistic you are you for reality being restored under potentially Prime Minister Keir Starmer?
I think you will face a huge amount of, I think it will galvanize people internally. So there has long been a sort of quite a strong undercurrent, a suppressed undercurrent of women in particular within the Labour Party. And I think you will see more heads above the parapet because I can't imagine this is really the hill he wants to die on. I mean, it is, apart from anything else, such an embarrassingly middle class issue. Who the hell has the time, apart from Oxford students, to wang on about their gender identity? I mean, just get over it. ridiculous. So I think it would be sort of embarrassing if he made a massive political issue of it. And it would probably just seem irrelevant and strange, I think, to the majority of Labour Party supporters. But yeah, I mean, see, my own Tory MP has refused to meet with me for the past 8 years to discuss this. So, you know, I think actually, yeah, I mean, it does sort of surpass politics in a way. Yeah, I think Keir Starmer, I mean, there's a little bit of movement there, but essentially, I mean, really, I guess the one we should be working on, if we're going to work on anyone in the Labour Party, is probably the god-awful Angela Rayner, who I see as a weird sort of mirror image of Boris Johnson in a way, but whatever. Yeah, I mean, I suspect it'll probably be her at some point in the quite near future.
Okay, that's a very interesting point there. Mirror image of Boris Johnson, in what sense?
Oh, in that they both obfuscate their ill-thought-out politics behind their image, behind their identity. So, you know, Boris with his sort of blustering and classical references, and Angela Rayner with a, you know, a fag hanging out of her mouth and sort of hamming up the working class thing. I just think in a way they're both very surface, and both savvy in that they're out to, protect their own skin rather than further the ideology that they believe in.
Yeah, we do often find ourselves bemoaning the lack of charismatic politicians until they appear, and then we think, maybe this
is like, that's the problem.
Desirable feature after all.
Yeah.
As I said, you've written many articles about many different subjects. I mean, across culture, across politics. What are some issues you're hoping to explore in your writing in the future?
So I'm really interested in the way that technology reshapes our brains, in the way that, you know, I know there's sort of a panic around AI at the moment, but just little things like I noticed I no longer walk downstairs in a normal way because I've always got my phone in my hand. So I do like a plodding one leg first, you know, and that's just such a minor thing, but indicative of so much more. So, yes, I'm really interested in the impact that that the digital world is having on how we think and our relationships with one another. I'm also quite interested in trying to dig into the truth around green energy, which I suspect is a load of hokum.
Well, do feel free to write for us on that, because that's an issue we've covered. The Critic is a good one for us, so absolutely. And I know what you mean, sadly, about walking downstairs carrying your phone, because as I was coming out of my gym yesterday, I nearly killed myself browsing through Twitter and missing a step.
Go to the gym, it's dangerous.
Absolutely, I could have just stayed at home.
Just risk a heart attack.
That's all right. I couldn't have done that on the sofa. It's true. Yeah. Thank you so much for joining me today, Jo Bartosz. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, likewise. Thank you.
Thank you.